remember hearing the Buddha say, my teaching is like the ocean. It has just one taste. Like the ocean has the taste of salt. These teachings have the taste of freedom, of unbinding. Recently, I've been reading a book by Thanissaro Bhikkhu, Jeffrey DeGraff, I think his lay name is, called The Mind Like a Fire Unbound. And in it, he talks about the early Vedic tradition of fire. It's not understood the way we understand fire. Fire doesn't, in the early Vedic tradition, fire does not go out, does not disappear. It's simply present, you could say in potentiality, unless it has a source of fuel. And then it manifests. And so the image that the Buddha took of nirvana, of the fire going out, sometimes it's translated like extinction. The true etymology of that is to be unbound, to be freed from, to be released from, to be relieved from the sustenance or the fuel of what causes the fire to burn. So his understanding of nirvana is to unbind, to be unbound, to be free. Sometimes when we read about it in the literature, we understand it as kind of extinction, or we're totally done, you know. But we're actually, the way he talks about it, from the understanding of the Buddha using the Vedic kind of metaphor and their understanding of fire at that time, it was to be unbound, to be released. And the question comes up, released from what? Do we have anything to be released from? Is there anything binding us? Is there anything obstructing us? Is there anything obscuring you? Obscuring me, obscuring, is there anything that's anything left to do? Or are we completely finished? And shall we all go home now? I mean, because we're unbound? Or is there still work to do? One of the, what I've been thinking about lately, about Buddhist truth, what the Buddha taught, is that basically what I've come to appreciate a lot recently is its pragmatism. It's almost tough reality. When we come here and we sit, we face a wall, we have the kind of tough job, the tough reality of being with our body and our mind just as they are. And we have to meet them. We come to a wall and we stop, right? Unless some of you have powers that can go through the wall, but basically facing the wall in this way is acknowledging that we're willing to stop, that we're willing to pause. We're acknowledging that there's work to do, that we have something to meet. We have ourselves to meet. So we put ourselves in this position where we face a wall, where we meditate, where we're still and quiet together, and we do the work day by day, or whenever we can. This pragmatism of the Buddhist teachings, I find, well, to be honest, I'm a little bit careful about what I eat mentally. And so in studying Buddhist teachings or looking at Buddhist teachings, I very much appreciate that the Buddha and the Buddhists and the ancestors of the people that followed the Buddha kind of told it like it is. You know, the noble truths, the four noble truths, basically said that, well, that unhappiness exists. Let's admit it, okay? Let's admit that life is fine, but in this mix of existence, unhappiness does exist. Discomfort does exist. Discontent does exist. That's a kind of not your ordinary sort of religious message. Usually a religious message would be to kind of build a solution or a story or a kind of understanding. But right away the Buddha says, let's look at this. Let's look at this. This is human existence. Please, let's look at this together. Let's look. Suffering does exist. Discomfort does exist. Fear does exist. Let's look at this together. And that it has a cause. And that it's optional. And that there's a path. Those four truths I like it. I like it very much that the Buddha looked at life in this very direct and forward way without giving us candy, so to speak. I like that the Buddhist teachings much of the Buddhist teachings don't explain, don't try and explain or embellish our existence, or even explain too much what we sometimes call a realized existence, or what enlightenment is, or what the truth is. Basically, a lot of the teaching, most of the teaching, explains or pays attention to what it's not. So it says, the Buddhist teaching says often, let's look at what is obstructing you. The five hindrances. If we study the five hindrances, attachment to sense desires, ill will, restlessness, sluggishness, torpor, ignorance. If we study those things, if we look at those things and we see them existing in ourselves, and we meet them, we meet these hard truths of these hindrances, then having put aside ill will, having put aside attachment to sensual desires, having put aside sloth and torpor, having put aside ignorance, having released ourselves from that, having done the releasing, the unbinding from that, then we can say, what remains? What's left? And my proposition, or my thinking these days, is whatever's left is the way. Whatever's left is awakening. Whatever's left is unbinding. The absence of those five hindrances is unbinding. Of those five hindrances is release, is nibbana. Nothing extra. There's no, like, special state. There's no, you don't get dessert. you don't get a special certificate. You just get released from what hinders you. And what's left is, it's your liberation. It's your liberation from those five hindrances. And that's where we work. We don't work in the big frame of liberation. We work with liberation here and now as it is, with our particular habits and attributes and problems, and noticing what comes up. Sitting like this, being still and quiet, helps us to notice that, notice our mental states and so on. So I think that's great about Buddhism, that they're not feeding you another story. They're just saying, the Buddhist teaching is just saying, drop off this, get rid of this, release yourself from this, unbind yourself from this, and see what's left. See what happens. See what remains. We kind of have these various kind of maps or lists. The other one, they're called the kleshas, which are poisons or stainings. Greed, hate, and delusion, or attachment, aversion, and ignorance. I mean, there's different definitions of it. So, sitting here like this, being quiet, being mindful, practicing, we have this opportunity to look at our kleshas, to look at that which stains us, that which obstructs us. And we can ask ourselves, having dropped off attachment and aversion can manifest itself as withdrawal, but also as anger or resistance. Having dropped those off, having dropped off our tendency or habitual patterns to ignore what's going on, pretend it didn't happen, having dropped off the three kleshas, even for a second, you know, even for a moment. I think the encouragement of the Buddhist way is for us to inquire what's left, what's here, what remains. Another one is the asaravas. Asaravas were the traditional descriptions of obscurations. Asarava, I think asarava, the etymology actually means to stain, but it also means to swell or to puff up, like a sore, like a boil or a sore. So it's sometimes described as, this is kind of gross, but it's sometimes described as an effluent or like a oozing. We're leaking. An asrava is to leak our potentiality, to leak our life. There's asrava of, what are they? There's a kamasrava, the leaking that has to do with actions, certain actions we make, a kind of how we miss it, how we drain energy, make a mess, kamasrava. And there's bhavasrava, which is the asrava of becoming, like trying to keep things going, or conversely to kind of push things away. There's dith asrava, atrava is the asrava of views. We have preconceptions or concepts. We kind of have an overlay of what this is or what that is or what this person is. And, we leak, we obstruct ourselves from seeing things as they are, by having a view, by having a preconception. And there's also, Ajiv asrava, which is just to completely ignore, to not obstruct it necessarily with a view, but just to miss it entirely. So this leaking is another description, and there's various ways to leak. I mean, we can leak, for instance, like if we have an idea of our self-importance, and we're coming into, we're meeting another person, and we have an idea of our self-importance. We can leak by, being afraid. It's kind of like a hole in the bottom of a bucket. It's leaking out of the bottom of the bucket. And we can lose our energy, lose our vitality, lose our sense of being present by kind of leaking by being afraid, wanting this person to respect you or something or approve of you, and being afraid, and we leak from the bottom. Or we can have a big idea about what a great person I am, and we can leak kind of like flooding over the top of the bucket and just spill, make a mess that way, leak that way by kind of going over the top, so to speak. So the asravas is another description of of our human condition, of what we're capable of, the kind of trouble we're capable of getting into. And the early Buddhists really studied this stuff. They, an arhat, a realized disciple of the Buddha, an arhat, was one who dropped off the asravas, Drathap, he was free of outflows. That practitioner had practiced and released himself from these outflows, and he was what remained then. He was what was left. He was free. He was unbound by those obscurations. When I was thinking about this, it's kind of like, what's his name? Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes. He had this statement, how did it go? Maybe you can help me out. Whatever.
All the possibilities are extinguished. What's left is the truth. Something like that.
It was like when you eliminate everything that's impossible, then whatever remains,
even if it seems like it
doesn't work, then nevertheless it's what's true, you know. So it's kind of this kind of a correlation of this. The teachings encourage us, and our work on the cushion supports this, that if we eliminate greed, hate, and delusion, then whatever remains must be the truth. Must be what's left, must be unbinding. At any rate, that's how my thinking has been going lately. Like, I really appreciate the pragmatism, I guess you'd say, of Buddhism, that it works, that it has to do with the human condition. That yes, it has religious qualities, and it may have certain understandings, which we could even call beliefs. But it has a lot of fluff and interesting stuff, you know, on the surface. But underneath, it's this pragmatism, this kind of working pragmatism of looking at ourselves, seeing what a problem is, eliminating the problem, and then seeing what's left. I think that's cool. I really like that about Buddhism, that it's almost direct that way, you know? Nothing to believe. This is experiential. Try it out for yourself. See what happens. Nothing has to be accepted beforehand. Just experiment like a scientist. You know, set yourself up as a one-person laboratory, and you know, mix it and see what it's like to be free of the obscuration of sloth and torpor. See if you can, you know, meet life with energy and vitality, and meet everything you meet, even a cup of tea, with your full physical presence and brightness, bright eyes, like Kobenchino Roshi said. Igen, it's called, bright eyes. Bright eyes, he used these terms a lot. He said, bright eyes become, the term is, gen is eye in Japanese, and igen means like right eye or correct eye or bright eye. But he translated it as bright eye. Or it means like you're ready, you know? You're ready. Bright eye turns into hogen, which is the eye that sees dharmas, the eye that sees things as they are. And Hogen becomes Butsu Gen, I am Buddha, that sees the emptiness and the interdependence of all existence. I have one more little thing, since it was Bodhidharma Day today. That's right, Bodhidharma Day. Hooray. Happy birthday, Bodhidharma. Or was it his birthday or his
Memorial
Day? Yeah. This is another teaching. We don't know. This is from a long time ago. We don't know how accurate this is ascribed, but it's ascribed to Bodhidharma. And this is another very practical, down-to-earth, let's get to work kind of teaching from Bodhidharma. And it kind of parallels the Four Noble Truths. This is from Red Pine's book on the teachings of Bodhidharma. The first one, these are kind of labeled as entry practices. So this is how you kind of set the stage for starting to do the work. To enter by practice refers to the four all-inclusive practices, and these are the four: suffering. This sounds a little strange. Suffering and justice, adapting to conditions, seeking nothing, and practicing the Dharma. The first one, maybe better translation is, this is from Cleary, it's compensation for opposition. So what this means in effect is, you have a certain situation of your life, and it's conditioned, right? It's conditioned by your past karma. And not only your past karma, but the karma or the conditions or the circumstances of your culture, of your ancestors, of all your past actions, whether you've been a good boy and girl or a bad boy and girl, whether you've been to jail or you've never been to jail and you're like pure, whatever the situation is, you're conditioned by those right now. You're conditioned by all those past actions. So what the first thing that the Bodhidharma is saying is, study that, look at that, and accept your situation right now based on all your past karma. Start with that. Say, okay, I'm such and such, this happened to me, this is the situation, this is where I live, this is how much income I make, I'm accepting that. And it's based on past karma. So you remember your past mistakes, your karmic debts, and you accept them. You accept them as phenomena. You accept them as this is the way it is. And you basically meet them and acknowledge them. That's the first one. The second one is according with conditions. It means that the next step is that you accept the phenomena of your life as it is, whatever those conditions are, and you accord your life. In other words, you tune your life, which is what we're doing in practice. You tune your life to be, to not ignore them, to be aware of your life situation. And you basically, the second step is saying you start to practice. You start to actually really practice. Like what we do when we're on the cushion. We sit down, we shut up, we face a wall, we look at our body and mind, we bring our whole life in accord with our consciousness, our presence at that moment. The third one is called no object of seeking. Or seeking nothing, and maybe I'll read this part, the third part. This is Red Pine talking, or to his translation of Bodhidharma. Third, seeking nothing. As the people of the world are in delusion, they're always longing for something, always, in a word, seeking. But the wise wake up. They choose clarity over custom. They fix their minds on the elevated and let their bodies change with the seasons. All phenomena are empty, containing nothing worth desiring. They recognize calamity, that calamity forever alternates with prosperity. In other words, they accept, this is accepting the transitoriness of existence. To dwell in the three realms is to dwell in a burning house. To have a body is to know suffering. Does anyone with a body know absolute peace? Those who understand this and detach themselves and stop imagining and seek nothing. The sutra says, they attain the way. And the fourth one is conforming with the truth. Again, this is very practical stuff. Fourth, practicing the Dharma. The Dharma is the truth that all natures are pure. By this truth, all appearances are empty. Defilement and attachment, subject and object, don't exist. The sutra says the Dharma includes no being and as such is free from the impurity of being. And the Dharma includes no self and as such is free from the impurity of self. The wise understand this truth and are bound to practice according to the Dharma. What is real includes nothing worth begrudging, so they give their body, their life, and their property in charity, without regret, without vanity of giver, gift, and recipient, and without bias and attachment. To eliminate impurity, they teach others, but without becoming attached to form. Through their own practice, they're able to help others and extend the way of enlightenment. As with charity, they also practice the other virtues. But while practicing the six virtues to eliminate delusion, they practice nothing at all. This is what is meant by practicing the Dharma. Good luck with that. And wish me luck too, because I'll need it. So these are the what's called the entry practices of the Bodhidharma. I think that's enough, isn't it? Goodness. Does anyone have anything to say or have a question?
You said that you haven't been teaching lately, and I was wondering if that's because you're painting more.
Yes.
And,
ashamed.
And the talk that you gave at Jikoji, you talked about how COVID discouraged you from painting, because you were too attached to the outcome. And I was wondering if your relationship with painting has changed. And
recently?
Yeah.
No? Well, I'm not sure. I think my relationship to the process has always been the same, but in the last couple of years I've had a little more energy to work and to do that kind of work. And starting to show a little bit, so. I'm still a hobby painter, though, like Copeland said. You know?
Still a hobby.
Hobby painter, you remember? Remember what Vanya asked, brought up that question? Were you there? Was that the talk
you referred to? Said that Copeland said it should be a hobby.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, he did, yeah. A little background is I used to be a professional, I guess, such as it is, a painter, and I taught art for many years and taught in universities before I took on these ropes. And so it was quite an adjustment for me to be a hobby painter. So maybe I'm a hobby painter that's a little bit busier this year. What do you think about the practicality, the pragmatism of this Buddha way? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it's what drew me to practice was the practicality, the BS kind of talk.
Yeah. And that straightforward,
like,
huh?
More of a practice, I think, feels like more like a subtractive thing. It's more like taking away things like the hindrances or when I add things like, you know, the idea of what I should be doing or certain study or something like that, I think I get more confused. But what feels more organic for me is this feeling of dropping things.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I had in mind. And it somehow, as I drop things, it's interesting how things replace it. You know, like if I drop, say, just be angry. If I drop anger, I'm open to generosity or something.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been kind of, that's always kind of rang true for me.
Uh-huh.
Is that process?
You made room for it, right?
Huh?
You made room for it.
Yeah. So I wonder sometimes if it's just more about getting out of the way than it is about learning about things. You know what I mean? Learning about. I guess they both have their place, but it feels like. In my practice, it seems like what seems to get me feeling more grounded is when I peel away things rather than trying to add things to my house.
Yeah. Yeah, like instead of building an extension to your house, building an extra room, you maybe get rid of some furniture, and suddenly you've got a lot more room without that addition. Yeah.
Could you share any examples of how you've become unbound over the last 10 years or last month? Or?
I'm studying, or I'm carefully looking at how I get bound by a view, by dithasrava, by the outflow or the swelling based on having a view, having an opinion. That seems to be my where I create the most trouble, and. Since I live in a so-called intentional community, you know, in a residential Zen center, it's a small amount of people, we become a kind of a close family in a way, but like any close relationship, it has its issues and problems, and I've been watching how that I have like the Metta Sutta says, no holding to fixed views. I commonly hold to fixed views about what Sangha is and what Jikoji Sangha is and how Jikoji Sangha should be and how, and yet my actual nature is to be very, not to be strict. Not so much with myself either, but particularly with other people, not to be strict, but coming from an artistic temperament rather than like a business or scientific, I have less tendency to make rules for myself and others. So I like things to be more organic and casual, and have everyone be an adult, be self-motivated, you know, and sometimes they don't, and sometimes I don't either, you know. Sometimes I'm a bad boy, and but all around that is my problem. My ongoing problem with holding to fixed views or having a fixed view about this is the way it should be done. Not that way, but this way. So my practice is to notice that I'm holding onto a fixed view, an opinion, a bias, really, you know. And then without releasing that bias, kind of make it bigger or make room around it, you know. And it's hard. It's really hard because I'm usually right, you know, in my biased opinion. Yeah. But how to accommodate and be receptive to other views, not just other views, but even a slightly different version of the view I'm holding, you know. Someone else's take on it is—it's really hard work. Have you noticed? It's really tough. Yeah. So that's what I've been working on. How about you? What have you been working on?
Noticing. You know, I think the same thing. Over the last 6 months or so, I'm just getting a lot better at noticing. Things not being the way I want them. Kind of catch it right away and go, oh, wow, what's going on here?
And about making some judgment about it?
Ones that can really, yeah, you know, yeah, ring a bell. And usually they are, the conclusion is don't sweat the small stuff. Sometimes it's something real and a problem. But noticing. particularly stress or fear or anger.
I could include myself in that too, because I'm a kind of Buddha family type. I tend toward just ignoring or being just kind of just push that over to the side and not ignore it. It's a, in other words, like I'll obstruct reality by just pretending it's not, the situation is not there or something. Anybody else? I don't mean this to be confession time, but yeah. Yeah, I agree. If you weren't doing that, that would be ignorance. That would be a klesha, you know.
Yeah.
Greed, hate, and delusion. You're deluding. You know, you're not seeing things as they are. So yeah. So that's always a delicate point, that's always an issue that comes up when you have a view. When you have a view or an opinion or you know something's, you know, how to hold it, you know, how to hold it so it's workable, but it doesn't, it's not binding you, you know, yeah. The experience we have when we meditate it's perfect parallel to this. If we're holding things too tight or too loose in our practice doesn't function well, you know. There's some workable middle ground, you know, that's always the right place to proceed from. And we know that because if we try and force attention, if we try and make attention a kind of attention in practice, a kind of an assignment or a project, and do this forceful engagement in our practice, it won't succeed. It'll run itself out of energy if it's forced that way. And if practice is too loose and too casual, of course, we'll miss it too. So, yeah, very good point. Very good point. What's nice is this is all, you know, working stuff. You know, how to work, how to work together. How are we doing?
About time.
About time? Okay. Well, let's keep up the good work together, okay?
Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I